Welcome back to Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi, excited to bring you episode 3 today, which features an interview later on with the incomparable Sierra Hull. She's a 3-time International Bluegrass Music Association Mandolin Player of the Year. She's a Grammy nominee, and she's also a super cool lady. We've really enjoyed getting to know Sierra over the years, playing with her a ton and watching her amazing career unfold. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk about Bela Fleck's advice as a producer, the current state of bluegrass affairs, what Sierra is listening to now, and all kinds of other fun things. But before we get to our interview with Sierra, I want to dig in a little bit to the current state of bluegrass affairs right here and now, because I think it will help give us some context and help us understand the importance of the kinds of artists that I'm having on Inside the Musician's Brain, guys like Paul Hoffman, Green Sky, Billy Strings, and definitely Sierra, to understand a little bit more where their music came from and how they fit into the bigger musical picture that's stirring out there. So let's jump right into an abbreviated history of the music. Most aficionados agree that the advent of bluegrass was in 1946, when Earl Scruggs' three-finger banjo style, combined with Bill Monroe's songcraft that was derivative of gospel, country, blues, and string band traditions, to form a version of Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys that is widely regarded as the gold standard of bluegrass. They had a legendary performance on the Grand Ole Opry in December of that year, and that kicked off an incredible 2-year run of music. And after those 2 years, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs break off to form their own seminal group, Flatt and Scruggs, while Bill Monroe continues his pioneering work with a rotating cast of players over the years that follow. So bluegrass is born 1946, and immediately, since this style has gravity and people are connecting to it, other people start learning this stuff and playing bluegrass, and along come the Stanley Brothers, who learn everything Monroe plays on his radio show, and then they play it on their broadcast within a week's time. The musical style starts taking root and starts to grow. And just as soon as it starts to grow, it starts to evolve, because the new voices that are coming into bluegrass are putting their own twist on it. If you look at the Stanley Brothers, they sort of add this old-time mountain element, and this is a theme in bluegrass, as it is with any thriving style. New voices are coming into the music, they're incorporating new and different influences, and they're doing things their own way. Sometimes that's more subtle, sometimes it's more drastic. So now bluegrass is getting established, and you have all kinds of new artists coming into the fold. Reno and Smiley, the Osborne Brothers, Jimmy Martin, and again, these are all innovators in their own right. They're drawing on what Monroe did, but they're also moving the music forward. So baked into bluegrass's early history, you not only have a very set example of what this sound is supposed to be, Flatt and Scruggs, Bill Monroe, but you also have an incredible spirit of innovation. And I think that that often gets overlooked today, but we'll get back to that part. So bluegrass is taking root, more bands, more fans, but the music never really attains any commercial or mainstream success. Bluegrass's notoriety is bolstered by the folk boom of the 1960s. Around that time, you also have the advent of music festivals, which definitely helps bluegrass to get out there. And then you also have these anomalous one-off instances of bluegrass being exposed to a much larger audience. And Olden in the Way in the 1970s is a great example of that. Jerry Garcia, avid banjo player, teams up with Grisman, Rowan, Vassar Clements, John Kahn, and creates a version of bluegrass that is going out to the Grateful Dead fan base. So bluegrass is hitting all these new ears, but it still remains a relatively underground style, despite the fact that we have essentially this early proof through bands like Olden and The Way that it could have a much broader appeal. Now, I should say that we can't even possibly get close to mentioning all the influential bluegrass bands that are coming around during this time. The Country Gentlemen, the Kentucky Colonels later on, J.D. Crowe and the New South, the Seldom Seen, the Johnson Mountain Boys. Bluegrass music is still producing some of the most incredible, virtuosic, soulful music all through this period, despite the fact that it's not really attaining huge amounts of success or mainstream appeal. And by the 1980s, Bluegrass in its more traditional form, even though there are some great bands around, is essentially in decline. And this is where things start to get really interesting as we head toward the turn of the century. The music starts to undergo evolution like it really had never known before. Guys like Grisman, Sam Bush, Tony Rice, Jerry Douglas, and Bela Fleck are taking the music in drastically new directions, all still essentially rooted in those traditional styles of playing, but such an eclectic new set of influences are coming in, and the music that's being produced is really taking things a step further. Bands like Newgrass Revival and the seminal progressive album The Telluride Sessions are showing people the endless possibilities of this incredible form of music. And it's also around this time that we start to see huge advancements in the technology that surround the production of live concerts. New venues, bigger lighting rigs, better sound, and also pickups for the acoustic instruments as opposed to the microphones that had always been used and are still mostly used in the traditional world. These factors are all becoming a way of life for musicians who are coming up in this era. Now, these production elements aren't something that traditional bluegrass music was ever known for, and it still isn't today. But if you look at the cutting edge of bluegrass, not only are the songwriting and the playing styles evolving at a rapid rate, but so too are people's imaginations around how this music can be presented. And it's at this time that we start to see the origins of the jamgrass movement. Leftover Salmon forms in 1989, followed by the String Cheese Incident and Yonder Mountain String Band in the late 90s, and bluegrass music is off and running in an entirely new direction. It's not just the music that's evolving, but also the way that that music is presented in a live environment. Bands like Salmon, Cheese, and Yonder are touring, playing shows in clubs, selling hard tickets with a production, lights, and sound that had never really been associated with bluegrass before. And they're also drawing on post-Grateful Dead elements of experimental live shows, tons of jamming, and also the word-of-mouth fan base factor. And all these elements are coming together to create so much more accessibility and popularity around progressive bluegrass. Now, a key quick part of this discussion is that traditional bluegrass people would probably tell you that these new forms of music aren't bluegrass. And while I don't agree with that, I think we can all agree that there's really no set definition of the music. But it is pretty indisputable to say that these new forms of music are absolutely related to bluegrass and are an evolution of the style. Yes, bands like Cheese are bringing in drums and electronic elements that clearly were not a part of old school bluegrass, but they're also playing fiddle tunes, and there's mandolin, guitar, and fiddle all represented on stage. And then look at Yonder, a four-piece band, mandolin, guitar, banjo, and bass. They're playing their own songs, but they're also doing tons of bluegrass covers, John Hartford songs. It's clearly a new vision of bluegrass music. And the same can be said for a lot of the bands that we see having so much success today. Now, the traditional world soldiers on through this time and still sticks to its core values, the sound of Bill Monroe and Flattin' Scruggs, and they don't embrace all the evolution that's going on, and they're not able to tap into the mainstream success that bands like Yonder and Cheese are experiencing. But a whole new model, a whole new template for what the music can be and what kind of fan base it can reach are being established. And that's what's given rise to the bluegrass movement that we are a part of today. Bands like Green Sky, Railroad, The Dusters, festivals like Winter Wondergrass and Strings and Soul, none of this stuff was going on 15 years ago. But fast forward to today, and we really see two distinct worlds of bluegrass music. One more traditional, with less commercial appeal. One more progressive, with a much bigger fan base. And my big theory about why things have shaken out this way is that traditional bluegrass fans are not like normal music fans. And that's because a lot of traditional fans also play the music. It's not like rock and roll where you need drum kits and amps and a dedicated space. We can just pick up and play banjos and fiddles in the living room. And with all that extra invested time and energy comes an increased ownership over the style and so many opinions about what the music should be. So on the one side, you have this growing, evolving style and all these open-minded fans who are just discovering it for the first time. And on the other side, you have a more traditional vibe where you have fans who are really deeply into the music and they get it. and they know what they're talking about and they play it well, but they also, they know what they like and they care about preserving those core aesthetic values, and they don't necessarily value that evolution element. It's just a way of life in traditional bluegrass, even though a lot of those artists would love to be exposed to these newer fans. Now, whether it would actually connect aesthetically and whether they would dig it, that's kind of another question entirely. But if I had to guess, I would say that they would in some way, but you can debate about that all day. And regardless, it's plain to see that these days bluegrass really is in these two very separate worlds. And it really remains to be seen whether those old school fans can embrace that evolution factor. And if you're wondering, why does any of this even matter? Why would the traditional world need to open its arms to more progressive strains of the music? I would say it's simply to shine a light on some of the incredible trad acts that are out there, the deep quality old school sounds that are still being produced today by so many quality acts that would love the possibility of that increased exposure. And I would also say that it's the fans who really hold the key to this connection of these two worlds of bluegrass. And by no means am I telling traditional fans what to do, but simply pointing out that this possibility is out there, and also reiterating the fact that traditional artists, by and large, are absolutely in favor of it. And only time will tell how that situation will shake out, but it sure is an interesting question to ponder, and I always tell people, bluegrass music, especially in its more traditional forms, will live on for one very simple reason. It's so badass. The music is just incredible, incredibly deep, culturally rich, and I feel so lucky to be a part of it. Okay, I think that does it for the abbreviated history lesson, but that's actually a great segue to my interview with Sierra Hull, who is an artist who has bridged that gap herself. I would argue that she started out in the more traditional world, but these days, her music and her fan base are branching out in incredibly vibrant ways. I'm proud to call Sierra a friend, but mostly I'm just a fan. She is such a shredder and an incredible songwriter and singer as well, and I'm just excited to see where her career takes her. So without further ado, let's jump ahead to my conversation with Sierra Hull from about a month back. Okay, we're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and we put this one together on short notice, but I have to say, from the time that I had the idea to do the podcast, this lady's name was on a really short list of people that I hoped that I would get to connect with. We're in the presence of bluegrass royalty today. Three-time reigning International Bluegrass Music Association Mandolin Player of the Year, and just an incredible singer-player. And also a really cool and genuine lady who we've enjoyed getting to know and play with over the past few years, Sierra Hull. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm so excited you're doing this.
I'm so excited that I'm doing this with you right
well,
now.
Thanks for having me.
This is awesome. Let's get deep.
So, let's do it.
Yeah, we're here at a festival in Virginia where the Dusters are playing and Sierra is playing as well. And we're gonna have some jams. But I like to start out by just kind of talking about, you know, your start with your journey in music. And I know that you've been playing since you were a youngster. And actually, we were trying to guess last night. How old were you when you did the Opry with Allison?
So the first time I played with Krauss on the Opry, I was 11.
11 years old.
I just turned 11 years old,
okay.
Yeah.
You know what I was doing when I was 11? not playing on the Grand Ole Opry. That's really cool. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the real flame, the thing that kind of made you decide, okay, you know, I've obviously got a thing here with music, but I'm going to devote my life to this. I'm going to put all my energy into creating original music and getting out there and playing it for people.
Yeah, well, you know, I always heard music as a kid in church and, you know, around. I grew up in rural Tennessee, about 2 hours northeast of Nashville, a little town called Birdstown. And, you know, there's a lot of music in that area in general. People kind of just play and sing as a way of life, you know, not necessarily everybody's trying to be on a stage, but It wasn't uncommon to hear my granny sing or, you know, my mom singing to me when I was, you know, 3 or 4 years old, teaching me songs. My brother brother and I. But my dad kind of got bit by the bluegrass bug when I was about 7 or so, and he started wanting to learn to play some instruments. My mom's uncle, who was our next door neighbor, was self-taught on mandolin and fiddle, and he wasn't a real skilled player. I don't know if he'd ever had any kind of lessons or knew that many chords, but he would always just be playing these, you know, little melodies on the mandolin or fiddle, and I would walk into their house. So those sounds were always familiar to me, so it wasn't that far-fetched of an idea to think that I would learn to play an instrument. And so my dad started trying to get my brother to play something, and then, you know, he's my only sibling, my older brother. I want him to do everything he did.
Oh, yeah,
so, you know, such a follower. But I was like, well, I want to play something too. And so my granny and her sister, my great aunt, and the uncle that I was talking about, they went in together and bought me a fiddle for Christmas, but it was a full size. It was just, I was tiny for 8 years old, so I couldn't really, it was just too big. I couldn't reach it. But my dad had just bought a mandolin and was starting to learn some tunes and some chords, and so he was like, well, hey, why don't I show you how to play a tune on the mandolin, because they're tuned alike, and we'll get you a smaller fiddle, but at least you'll kind of know how to play a song. You'll just have to figure out the bow. But so I was like, okay. And so he taught me how to play Bowl Them Cabbage Down or something like that, and I really just fell in love with it.
Yeah.
I spent the next few weeks learning some things on the mandolin, and then it, you know, kind of turned into, well, if you'll stick with it, we'll get you your own mandolin. Now, the tunes I was learning was on my Uncle Junior had sent a taterbug mandolin, the bowlback, like old Italian mandolins. We call them taterbugs in Tennessee, but he had kind of sent that down to our house, and my dad had that, and so that was what I learned my first few tunes on. And so my parents were kind of like, well, if you'll stick with it in a few months, like, we'll get you your own mandolin. And so I just really went for it. I just fell in love with it immediately, and I really can't remember a time when I didn't think I wanted that to be my life. You know, looking back on it, I feel like I kind of knew immediately, like, this is what I'm going to do. And maybe a lot of that had to do with, you know, when you're new to music, like, I didn't know anything about bluegrass. I'd grown up listening to some of, like, Dole Lawson and Quicksilver and some of those gospel songs. We would sing those in church sometimes. So I was hearing, you know, some bluegrass, but then I remember Dad getting a Larry Sparks tape and us kind of just really going, wow, this is awesome. And Tony Rice Church Street Blues was like an early, you know, cassette tape that we just were like, whoa, this is so great. And, you know, I slowly started like getting all these new albums every week and just kind of going, wow, these are my heroes and I want to do what they're doing. I want to do that.
When did the gigs start?
Well, funny enough, I started going to these jams on the weekend, so which was another reason I think that I really connected with the idea of just being a musician and playing. The community of musicians was huge for me. Like, I had a like a local jam about 30 minutes down the road that I could go to. My dad and I would go a lot of times on Friday and Saturday evenings. We would go to these local jams, and it would be, you know, looking back now, just me and a bunch of old dudes. You know, it's like, but they welcomed me into the, you know, these circle jams, and they're playing all this music from like Bill Monroe to Flatt & Scruggs to Stanley's and stuff that I maybe didn't even know that I was hearing Bill Monroe tunes, for example, but I was hearing this kind of catalog of music that we all now know and love and think of as sort of that traditional catalog. But I was learning this, and you know, just being welcomed in really made me go, man, I love this. This is really, you know, this is what I want to do. And so they started having me get up on stage, you know, at these little local things. Even before I could really play much, I would chop along. And then it wasn't long before, you know, they'd be like, why don't you and your brother play a few songs? So we sort of had these kind of like little local gigs that weren't paid gigs. They were just sort of like the people who would be jamming in the back room would maybe get on stage and play for a crowd of like
playing for people.
Playing for people, you know, 30, 40 people out there having a hamburger on a Saturday night here in Bluegrass. And then like churches would have us come play and things like that. And, you know, so then word kind of gets out, and before you know it, we're playing at this local event or this local event. And a lot of times it would just be me and my brother and my dad.
It's such a cool thing about bluegrass that I think people who are not involved with the community, they know music and they know music and there are different scenes and different genres, but bluegrass, I know I was definitely drawn in, you know, when I was learning to play when I was in college, just by the community, you know, jams. And friends and a scene, and all based around the music. And I was going to these jam sessions up in rural New Hampshire and Vermont. And it's amazing how I hear that story from a lot of bluegrass pickers,
yeah.
You know, welcomed into that world. And, you know, you sort of, you have this place, this musical home, and a lot of things really grow out of that and flourish out of that.
Yeah, know, absolutely. Really... Well, it's funny because it's like, you know, here I was, this little like 8-year-old girl or whatever, but I'm just like, yeah, these bluegrass dudes, these are my friends, mm-hmm. You know? It's just, there's like a bond that you get through playing music with people that's really special. And I was always excited to go, cool, I can't wait to get back and jam with so-and-so,
oh, yeah.
You know? And
I know when
same
I...
with my dad, you know, it was just this really special community.
When we go to play Grey Fox, you know, once every few years, and that's where that, you know, New England crowd is,
yeah.
And I still go connect with those same people.
So cool.
Who I jam. I'm sure probably the same for you. You see some of those old faces and
yeah, every once
like
in
proud.
A while when I it's so cool, you
yeah.
know, because these are, you know, people that I sometimes wonder if they realize how much they taught me.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Like I'm so grateful that I
yep.
had this like incredible learning ground.
Yep.
Just, you know, not only was it fun, but I was just learning a ton from,
right.
And these weren't professional players.
Sure.
They're, you know, people that just did it for fun because they loved it.
Well, you're grateful and we're grateful too, because it has definitely, you know, I want to say started, but you're well into your career now. And I want to kind of like fast forward a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about Weighted Mind, your last release. But I'm curious, what are your modern influences? Like, what music are you listening to now that you're digging on? You know, there's so much really cool production stuff on Weighted Mind, and it's not a bluegrass record. So what's playing for you these days?
Yeah, I jump around a lot. I love so many different styles of music. Like, you know, just yesterday I was playing some stuff for the guys in the band, and you know, I just watched some of the Ken Burns documentary.
Oh, cool.
And like some of the Jimmy Rogers stuff, and so like, you know, Miss the Mississippi and You? Yeah. Have you heard this track?
I have
Jimmy
not.
Rogers track?
No.
It's like unbelievable. And it's like,
yeah.
I was, you know, digging into some of that stuff. While at the same time, you know, it's like the Taylor Swift album just came out, and
yeah.
I was checking that out. It's like I try to check out a lot of, and not because I'm just like some big Taylor Swift fan, but
right.
It's like I kind of like to, you know, if a new album comes out by somebody that's sort of, you know, a thing in a even a cultural moment,
yeah.
You know, I like to try to give that a chance and listen to it. You know, I love everything from like digging back into old stuff. You know, there's always old favorites like Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, Dolly Parton, people like that.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, being able to check out some newer things that are
so,
kind of current, whether it's pop music or old kind of throwback, you know, jazz or whatever.
So as far as more current stuff, is part of that, you're, as an artist, thinking to yourself, there's something going on here. Many people are connecting with whatever it is, this new Taylor Swift album. You know, I want to kind of see what that's all about and try to understand
well,
that.
I think sometimes maybe you go, okay, well, you know, so-and-so was checking out this record, so I'm going to see if I like it. You know,
yeah.
Maybe I'm going to listen to it. But I'd say it's less about going, oh, a lot of people like this. What is it about it? You know, I'm not necessarily as concerned about that as just, like, trying to keep an open mind. I think, like, growing up so in the bluegrass world, you know, you kind of live in this little bubble sometimes
oh,
of,
yeah.
like, all I'm listening to is bluegrass. And as I, you know, for the first probably 8 to 10 years of my playing, it was, you know, totally bluegrass, which I'm really grateful for, because on one hand you get this unbelievable foundation, you're
oh, yeah.
very rooted in something, and I think that can be important, especially for a young musician to grow, to have really solid roots somewhere, something that they can kind of lean on a little bit.
For sure. And the and bluegrass as a foundation is a solid,
it's so, I mean,
technically,
it totally, it requires you to play at this really, the facility it takes to really play bluegrass well, there's a really high standard, you
yep.
know, to all the people that I grew up loving and listening to, that, you know, you're learning just an unbelievable amount from kind of staying in that one little area for a while.
You did good, Sierra Hall.
Oh, man.
You've learned your stuff, and
oh,
we're huge fans, you know, the guys and I, when we were coming here, you know, we were all sort of just talking about your music and what you've done, and we're really impressed, you know.
Well, thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah.
I'm fans of you guys, too. Well, I love what you guys do.
We're going to throw down and jam tonight, and I'm really looking forward to that. But I want to talk a little bit about Weighted Mind. So it's a few years old now. First question, personal question, just for me here. What was it like working with Bela as a producer? What was his style? What did he bring to the process? What was that like?
Yeah, well, it was really unbelievable. I mean, it's funny. It's like my answer is probably everything you would imagine. It was just really cool to work with somebody as brilliant as Bela.
Yeah. And for those of you, of you who don't know, Bela Fleck, banjo virtuoso, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, and he hasn't produced that many records, but he is known as a great producer, and so take us inside that process.
Yeah, well, so funny enough, I had been working on some new music, and I had gone in the studio with this great engineer in Nashville, a guy named Vance Powell, and I was kind of producing myself, and I cut these six tracks that were way more, I guess you'd call them Americana. It's like, what is Americana, you know? But kind of more like, there was, you know, percussion on some things, and like, I played guitar, acoustic guitar on a bunch of tracks. You know, there's electric guitar, everything from banjo to fiddle. I mean, a lot of like rootsy sounds still. But I cut these six tracks, and most of the songs are actually wound up on the project I did with Bela that became Weighted Mind. Weighted Mind was one of the songs that I cut in this completely different version with me playing guitar. And there was a song called Wings of the Dawn, Compass, what became the opening piece called Stranded on the project. That was recorded as like this extended instrumental.
Right.
There's all these tracks that that I had recorded, but then I started getting like all this feedback/pushback a little bit from the record label that just wasn't really sure. They weren't really sure what to do with it. They were excited that I was doing something else, but just were kind of in this, you know, strange place.
And I read, too, that from Bela, too, you handed off these demos to him, and some of them there were things in there that he was into, but maybe to rework and sort of revisit.
Yeah, totally. So just to back up just a little bit, you know, talking about Alison Krauss, she's been like a wonderful, you know, friend and mentor of sorts for many years. And, you know, I was just going through this. I'm so fortunate. I mean, she was my biggest hero. So it's like still really wild to me that she's somebody I can call up and be like, I don't know what I'm doing right now. I need some advice, you know. But I just kind of found myself in a slightly I hate to use the word dark, but kind of like a dark place about it all, where I just was like, you know, I'm excited about these songs that I've written, and I felt like for the first time that, you know, I had spent all this time in the bluegrass community, which I, you know, again, grateful for, loved, but people, you know, kind of knew me as this mandolin player, but like I had been writing a lot of songs over the, you know, the few years before recording Weighted Mind, and really felt like it was time for me to sort of put that forward as like, here's an album that's really about my songs and my songwriting, not that my other records were like, hey, check out all this. It wasn't like total shred fest or anything. I've always been very song oriented, but you know, it was the first time really writing like basically all the music for an album. And so I knew it needed to be focused on that. And I knew that I sonically just was ready to do something different, because as I was writing, it wasn't necessarily coming out in a real bluegrass style.
Sure.
So I knew it needed to be presented differently. But then I, you know, went and recorded these tracks, kind of got too many cooks in the kitchen from like record label management, just my mom. I mean, you name it, just too many people. You know, sometimes you can share things too early, and it was a really good, like, learning experience. But I kind of just had to step back and go, you know what? Like, I don't even know what I think about all this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I just need to pause for a minute. And so I remember, like, going to Krauss and kind of just saying, you know, I'm trying to finish this record. And I'm just at this point, I was producing myself, but I felt a little bit doubted by some of the people around me. Like, I know I was, you know, I get it, I'm young, but, I felt sort of ready to do it. But then I, you know, was getting this pushback. So I thought, you know what? I just really want somebody in my corner.
And now, was that pushback, like, you wanted to push the envelope, but they wanted you to sort of keep it more inside the box?
it's weird because on one hand I was hearing, oh, we're really excited that you want to do something that's not bluegrass.
Sure.
But then it's like the moment I try to do the thing that I think I need to do, it's just like, you know, before I even really had the opportunity to do it, I started getting a little bit of, you know, just... pushback. It was maybe I think everybody means well, you know, mm-hmm. but I just remember like one person from the record label saying to me like, well, you know, I think maybe you're trying to do too much. Like I remember, you know, like Allison, who I've always been compared to, and granted she's my hero, but you know, it was, this was a frustrating comment to hear from me, was like, you know, she's had a perfectly great career without ever writing any of her own songs. You know, it's like, there are a lot of things.
Oh my God, shame on the person who said that.
That crushed me because it was crushing because I thought, you don't get what I'm trying to do. Like, not that I think that my song, you know, I'm not the type of artist that feels like my song's over everything else. You know, it's like a bad song is a bad song. I'm not trying to just say I have to write all my own stuff. But there was like a real feeling that I need to put this out here. I don't know
sure.
why. I don't know why I felt like for the first time, in order for people to really hear me as me, I need to put this out here.
Amen.
And it
yeah.
just kind of felt like somebody was just going, you know, we think that you don't need to be trying to do that
yeah.
or like you're putting too much pressure on yourself or whatever. It just kind of got me in a weird spot. And so I started talking to Kraus about it and I was like, you know, I think I just really need to find somebody to produce me because, you know, somebody that really can be in my corner
right.
that understands what I'm trying to do.
And Bela was her suggestion.
And she suggested
yeah.
Bela. And that kind of surprised me because I've been a huge Bela fan my whole life, you know, but it's funny because this was the record that I was going, this is like the Sierra Hull singer-songwriter record, not, you know, me, like, shredding mandolin
mm-hmm,
record
mm-hmm.
necessarily. So I was like, huh. And because she said, you know who I think would be a good producer for you? She said, there's nothing musically he doesn't understand. And she said, I think he would be a great vocal producer.
Cool.
And she said, Bela. And so I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And then, you know, I knew Bela, but I wasn't close with him. You know, we had just kind of crossed paths
mm-hmm.
over the years, played a little bit together. And fast forward, like, a few months later, I'd kind of kept that in the back of my mind. But a few months later, I was at the IBMA award show, and somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and Bela and Abby were sitting right behind me. And I was like, huh, how funny is this? Just the guy I need to talk to.
And that's where you guys made the connection.
And we connected, and you know, one thing that Kraus had said to me, she said, well, even if he doesn't want to produce records or doesn't have time to do it, she said he would still be a really great person for you to just try to get some feedback from.
Sure.
Like, maybe you could go play your stuff for
yeah.
him and see if he has any thoughts for you. She said, I think that you would find working with him inspiring, which is really what I needed because I was getting the inspiration sort of sucked out of me by, you know, from other
yeah.
corners, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we just connected and I kind of, you know, threw the idea out there that I would just love to get together. And he, you know, because he asked me, like, what have you been working on? And I was like, oh, funny you should ask. And so, yeah, we just kind of hit it off. And, you know, I ended up going to his house and us talking about it. And I played him some things. And one of the first things he said to me, which I think was incredible advice, was like, you know, the production on this is really good. Like, the performances are all really good. Like, people are playing. But the thing that I think makes you really unique to you, I feel like, is maybe being covered up in these tracks. Because I was playing guitar quite a bit and a lot
okay.
of it, you know. It's like, I think part of me was maybe trying to put forth my, this other side of Sierra Hull so much that maybe...
So simplify.
Yeah.
Because kind of, Weighted Mind is a very stripped down instrumentation.
Totally.
It's mostly just mandolin, bass, and vocals
mm-hmm.
with Bela, and then some guest vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a freaking great record.
Man, thank you.
I love it. And
I
it's
really,
appreciate it. You know, it's an amazing balance of, and this is really hard to do. It's got a super strong, unique factor that it's its own thing. And that is the production, the instrumentation, but mostly the songwriting. I mean, the songs are really, really unique and you can
thank
hear
you.
That Bluegrass Foundation come out, but, it's a really strong original statement. You
thank
know,
you.
I love it. And I think that, you know, that it sounds like that advice to to let it be you, because it, that's what I hear. That's what I love about it is, you know, it's really, it is intimate sound, yeah. And you're right there, and you know, it's mixed yeah. that way, and it's played that way, and it sounds like
yeah.
he was part of what took you in that
direction.
Well,
one of the things that he really pushed me to do, which helped me, I feel like was some of the best advice I've ever been given, it really helped me grow tremendously, I think, was to have somebody like Bill. So I'll never forget the first time I go over to his house, and you know, we haven't even talked about him producing the record yet. This is just kind of like, we're just, you
checking
know,
it che- out. Yeah,
checking
yeah.
our vibes a little and sort of seeing what this process could look like, you know, and he says, do you think you could just, you know, we were listening to some stuff, and he said, do you think that you could just like play whatever song we had just listened to, the more like produced version of it, that I had recorded with Vance Powell, with mm-hmm. me producing. He said, can you just like play that for me on your mandolin? It was something that I'd written on guitar. And so then I was like, well, yeah, let me think about it, you know? So then I was like, okay. So like I played, I think it was the song Compass, which is like the first vocal mm-hmm. track on the record. And I played it, and he, you know, he goes, that. He said, that's what I think that you need to put out there for people to hear. He goes, because, you know, people haven't heard you like that yet. And so it was strange for me because, I, you know, I grew up playing bluegrass music, always in an ensemble with 4 to 5 people.
Mm.
I had never really thought that anybody would care to hear just me and my mandolin and my voice.
Yeah.
And to have somebody that I admire as much as Bela say, what if you did more of that?
Sure.
Kind of made me go, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let me think about that. And so it was like kind of a little weird and intimidating, you know, to be sitting there playing solo for Bela, you know, who's just such a great player and one of my heroes. But it was like having these kind of awesome lessons
yeah.
with Bela, these sessions where, you know, once that idea kind of came about, I started taking these songs, many of which I had already recorded, and going back to mandolin, which really is my instrument. I mean,
yeah.
I love guitar, and actually,
sure.
you know, fast forward, it's been like 5 years or something since we did Way to Mine. I'm in the process of working on a new record, and I'm kind of reintroducing the idea of me playing a little bit of guitar again,
yeah.
but it's been really great to kind of, you know, discover my voice on the mandolin in a different way than it would have been as, you know, it had sort of been portrayed in my bluegrass ensemble.
Well, it's really,
you know.
I love it. And it's cool to, like, sort of tie in Bela's advice, an artist, a producer, urging you to really do your own thing, which I love, versus some of that earlier advice that you got. And it's such a precarious thing, you know, artists ride that really fine line of inspiration and confidence with mixed with opinions from other people, you know, which
yeah.
of course have value, and we all have people that we trust, and we have our mentors, you know, and I love that it sort of came full circle like that, because it's really an awesome record, and you know, there's a, like I say, a real strong kind of coming of age theme on there. I'm curious to know sort of where you feel like you're at now. Like, what, I know you've got a new record that is slated to come out early next year.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the current Sierra Hull vibe, or what's the next thing that you're gonna sort of put out there?
Yeah, so, you know, it's like having done the record like Way to Mine that was so stripped down, and then taking so much of what I learned from Bela and just trying to sort of make sure that I, you know, some of the main advice that he gave me was like, you know, making sure that I wasn't like covering myself up with a bunch of other stuff, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of sounds like, well, yeah, that should be obvious. Like, if you're making a solo record, that you should leave room for yourself. But, you know, I love playing with other people, and I love hearing other people
yeah.
play on stuff. So it's easy for me to just be like, no, why don't you do this? That sounds so good. But also just trying to make sure that my voice is being heard in the way that really expresses me and what it is that I'm doing. This time around, I knew I wanted to make a record that maybe used the studio in a slightly different way. So almost, you know, having an opportunity to play, like, pretty much every record I've done so far has been whatever, like, Way to Mind was myself and Ethan Yojevitz on bass for the majority of the record. And we went out and we toured that record. We could basically play it note for note.
Yeah.
As in our live show.
The two of you, yeah.
this time around, I kind of felt like I wanted to experiment with the idea of being able to have at least some of the music on this record. There are things that are going to be on the record that are more live cuts, or, you know, there's a couple intimate guitar vocal things. We've currently cut more music than we need, so we'll see what all actually makes it on the record. But, you know, there'll be a mix of some stripped down things that are just more, you know.
All stuff you've written?
Yeah, written or co-written.
Co-produced it with Shawnee.
With Shawnee Gandhi, yeah. This great engineer in Nashville. And part of my wanting to use her is because sonically she just brings so much to the table. She's just a really great engineer. And I knew I wanted to do some things where I built some of the tracks. So where I could go in and maybe play multiple instruments, or I wanted to be able to sing some of my own harmonies this time around and experiment with, like, recording in that way. And maybe it's not something I can go do live, definitely not something I can go do live, but I wanted to just, you know, treat the songs, you know, individually as I thought they needed to be treated. And so Shawnee was a great partner, has been a great partner for working on this music with. And, you know, also the first time that I've got to work with a woman, you know, or first time I've worked with another woman and somebody so close to my own age. It's been a really kind of fun, cool experience to work with somebody that's more like a peer than, say, you know, an older hero.
And usually
an older male hero.
Yeah, and you know? Can maybe just go on a journey together, your contemporary, explore and feel empowered to be as much a part of that process as someone else, rather than listening and taking in information and advice.
Yeah. Well, and I also feel like we've been a good pair to work together, just because, you know, she's really good in, you know, in the engineering department, and she's got great ears, you know, even from like a producer standpoint, you know, of like, you know, when it comes to singing, having somebody in there that just has a really good ear to go, yeah, you know what, this lyric doesn't sound believable to me when you're singing it, or maybe you should try singing it like this.
Yeah.
You know, just like I don't know, it's just been really easy to work with her.
I
think that's when you know, kind of enjoy the process the most, is when you're working with somebody that just feels right.
Yeah, in the studio too. I'm, you know, I do a lot of studio work, and I'm a big believer in, you know, of course, as artists, we, the String Dusters, have had an ongoing conversation around, so we're going to record this music, how are we going to recreate it on stage?
Sure.
An obvious thing that you're always trying to figure out. But, you know, the studio is a great place to, you know, try stuff that you can necessarily replicate on stage. And then that thing on stage is going to be its own thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
I'm excited to check it out.
Thank you.
And I wanna kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about bluegrass and sort of where bluegrass is at and where it's headed. And, you know, we were talking earlier and I was saying, I think you have a really unique perspective on this because, you know, you've really walked the walk. You've sort of came up in the bluegrass ranks and as you said earlier, cut your teeth on a lot of really traditional bluegrass, and couldn't agree more that it's an amazing foundational musical element. I mean, technically speaking, the picking, the singing, there's something in there. And it's not just about doing it right. It's also a really soulful, deep thing. So there's not only the technical prowess, but also, you know, you can really emote through that music. And that's when you hear, you know, Monroe or Flatten Scruggs, it's like, man, that music really knocks you out. But fast forward to sort of the current day and Weighted Mind and now on to your new record, you're totally doing your own thing. And I love it. I think that that's great. I'm a really firm believer that the evolution of the music is going to be the thing that keeps it alive, because if traditional bluegrass just stays the same and remains sort of the art of imitation, no matter how good it is, it won't find new ears.
Totally.
And it needs to evolve. And so I guess first and foremost, thank you for being a part of that process.
Man. Thanks for the encouragement.
I can tell that you're stepping out and doing your thing. And you can hear that in the music. And that's, you know, it's compelling, it's original, it's really good. And I'm curious, first of all, to try and get inside, like, did you feel pressure from the bluegrass community when you started to do some things differently? Or at any point where, you know, you felt like you're stepping outside the box and maybe you were gonna alienate fans, or you're hearing opinions about doing things too differently, like, Were you aware of that? Did you sense that? How did that impact the direction of things?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I went in and when I was making the record that I, you know, what ended up becoming Weighted Mind, but the tracks that I cut originally, you know, I think that was maybe in the back of my mind a little bit, but I just knew I had to do something different. So I was trying to just, you know, forge ahead and do my thing. But then I think all the frustration set in for all the things I mentioned earlier. And then by the time I got working on it with Bela, there was a part of me that was so far over worrying about it. I just wanted to make the record I needed to make. Because it had been a long time coming, you know, this music that I'd just kind of just been chipping away at and trying to figure out how to present. And finally, by the end of Weighted Mind, it's like, cool, I'm excited about this record. Bela's excited about this record. And that's good enough for me. I'm gonna just put it out there and not worry about it. I just gotta do what I gotta do. And I honestly feel so lucky because for the most part I really didn't get any kind of crazy, I mean, at least to my face. Who knows what people are saying, you know, but I really felt really embraced by the bluegrass community by putting out that record. Maybe more than ever before. And it really surprised me. Like, it's funny, Weighted Mind was nominated for, like, Album of the Year at IBMA. And I was like, you know, I hadn't had bluegrass albums that had done that. And it sort of confused me a little bit, but I was like, wow, well, that's really nice to feel like, you know, I'm still feeling really, really welcomed by this community that I love so much.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, I don't want to alienate anybody, but I also, you know, don't want to just do something that feels unauthentic either. You know, we have to, I think, as musicians, make sure that we're following. I mean, people don't realize, if you're not a musician, I don't think anyway, that people can imagine what it's like to go out and play shows night after night after night. And if you're not doing something you really love and that you feel inspired and good about putting out there, I mean, that's a lonely existence. You know, it's like, I don't want to stand on stage and sing songs that don't feel like what I'm supposed to be doing.
Amen, sister.
You know?
You can only run from the bluegrass police for so long, people.
I mean, and let me just back up by saying, though, I love that music. I love bluegrass, but, you know, I, for one, am a woman. I couldn't sound like Bill Monroe vocally if I wanted to. Like, I don't have the voice of Jimmy Martin or all these people that I love.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I came of age listening to people like Alison Krauss and listening to bands like Nickel Creek. It's like, of course that's going to be in me. That's going to be the influence. I never got to meet Bill Monroe. Never got to hear the man play live. Of course, like, I go back now as, you know, as an older person and just, like, love that music. I mean, we were just listening to, like, some old Bill stuff just the other day, just last weekend on the road, and it's just,
it's so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But, like, the thing that I think makes it amazing is that it is so authentic to the man himself.
Yeah.
And of course, like I said, I'm grateful to have had the foundation of learning all that stuff, but it's like, you know, we're kind of, I think by trying to innovate or trying to move forward, you're actually able to kind of honor the spirit of Bill Monroe himself just
by
doing that.
Innovator.
Because he's the innovator,
the original,
you know?
The original innovator, no doubt. And people,
like, he didn't just copy somebody. He did what he thought he needed to do and in turn created this music that we're all so grateful that he did. And I'm not trying to say I would ever do anything like that because, you know, it's like how, you know, that's like, there's only a Bill Monroe that comes along every so often. But, you know, I think we have to at least try to follow our heart and play music that feels at least sincere.
Well, and he tried a lot of crazy stuff.
He did, I know.
Along the way that did not go so well.
And sometimes
and
when
he
people like
that.
Act like, oh, Bill Monroe, like that's not what Bill Monroe would do. But I'm just like, how much have you really dug into Bill Monroe's music?
I know.
Because, like, I mean, he did a lot of things were crazy and innovative, and people
and
don't always talk about that, you know?
They don't talk about it at all. As a banjo player, you know, it's like Earl Scruggs, I mean, for a big portion of his career, he was doing the Earl Scruggs Review, and it was like psychedelic concerts with drums and electric guitar. But, you know, people always, hindsight is 2020, and they have a very selective memory about those things. And I'm sure even though, and it's great to hear that you feel like you've been encouraged on this journey because that's the way that it should be. And also interesting, I never really thought about it, what you said, like, you're a woman. And so the precedent for what's out there, for what you're expected to copy, is maybe a little
sure.
less solidified than, you mm-hmm. know, and it's an interesting thing, you know, and you see traditional bluegrass these days and it's sort of kind of stuck in this little place where they know that the music is great. And I have their back on that, you
totally.
Know, and even though the same people are nominated every year for a lot of IBMA awards,
sure.
those people deserve the awards. And
they're really great.
Amazing
yeah, sure.
pickers. But for the music to move forward, it's really got to evolve.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It is, you know, they're the scene that, you know, that we're a part of, the String Dusters and bands like Green Sky and you know, Salmon, and it's evolving
yeah.
and it's catching a lot of new ears.
Totally.
And
I think that's amazing. I mean, because it's, you know, in an ideal world, you have people that just love all kinds of music,
that's
right?
That
can, you know, that the same fans that come out to your show could hear a Larry Sparks album and go, whoa,
well,
this is insane. You know, that to me would be the goal. And I, you know, I think that it's amazing that you guys can bring a younger audience to the table that might in turn go backwards, you know,
yeah.
dig from the more modern stuff that's happening now and go, cool, I got to know more about this and start digging
thing.
In and, you know.
I'm so proud when someone says that through the String Dusters, they like went back to Flat and Scruggs.
Yeah,
you know? And
totally.
That's the real stuff. And, you know, even though bluegrass does have sort of this lingering kind of identity crisis, you know, it's just, it's a great thing that people like you are out there who are, I say, doing the music justice, and I don't mean that because you're playing traditional bluegrass. I just mean that you know, and this I think also is sort of the String Dusters' mission, are taking the things from bluegrass that are so potent, so musical, so awesome, and recreating them or just letting them live on in your original sound.
Yeah.
And
I think that's the goal, you know, is just to take the stuff that you really love. I mean, that's really all we kind of do, right, is get inspired by something and try to take those, the things that we love, whether it's bluegrass or any genre, you
yeah.
know, take those things we love and you know, have it be spoken out through your own identity
that's
somehow,
right.
you know.
And I always say traditional bluegrass, and when I say traditional, I mean, you know, like the old stuff or Flat and Scruggs, Seldom Seen, all the good stuff, Country Gentlemen. That stuff, bluegrass, traditional bluegrass, will live on for one simple reason, because it's really badass.
It's awesome.
And there's
yeah, exactly.
and it's not, it doesn't require that people are sort of redoing it over
yeah.
and over. We all know that's great. And that's not to take anything away from those bands, but in their effort to sort of connect with the bigger bluegrass world that someone like you or, you know, I think some like the String Dusters are a part of, you know, there's got to be some recognition that, and we notice it all the time, fans who come out to hear us who don't know anything about traditional bluegrass, they can love 10 forms of music.
Totally.
They don't have that
same, like, protective nature, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if it's not this way, then
I think it's fear-based, you know, and I get it because, you know, it's like you love something and you're worried that it's, like, gonna die. But I agree with you that it's so powerful and so wonderful. It's not gonna die. It's
That's
not
right.
gonna die. I mean, you know, like, I've for the most part, like I said, been supported as I've tried different things. And it's been really, I don't want to say it surprised me, like, not that I, like, ever, like, doubt my audience, but just to even, like, you know, like, this festival tonight, I've got, you know, Eddie Barbash on saxophone and Mike Seal on electric guitar. And, you know,
oh, that classic bluegrass saxophone sound, everybody.
I know, but it's like, so I did this workshop earlier here at the festival, and so John, the guy that was hosting the workshop, was like, yeah, so Sierra's got, you know, this ensemble. And the whole crowd went, woo! Like, and I was like, oh my gosh, okay, cool. Like, they're excited to get to hear something. And I think that people are becoming more and more open to things. But it's like, you know, like I told that crowd, I said, you know, if you had said, oh, one day you're going to, you know, be touring with saxophone and an electric guitar, I would have just been like, oh, you're so crazy. Like, I'm not going to be doing that. If you told me that I was going to be, you know, making a record like Weighted Mine with myself and a bassist like Ethan, you know, just so stripped down,
yeah.
I probably wouldn't have really envisioned that either. So it's, you know, I think the music sometimes can even surprise us to where it takes us, and you know, if you kind of try to follow it. And I've just really tried to go, what inspires me? You know, like I mean, I like the saxophone, but I never went, oh, I think I need saxophone in my music. It really had nothing to do about the instrument itself. It's like, yeah. I heard this guy, Eddie Barbash, play,
yeah.
And I heard him jamming with Jake Jolliffe, who's, you know, mutual friend
sure,
of ours,
yeah.
Playing Bound to Ride by Ralph Stanley. And Eddie was shredding on the saxophone, yeah. Like playing like bluegrass, the rhythm and the phrasing and everything. It was obvious that he had been learning like bluegrass tunes, fiddle tunes, and old time tunes on the saxophone. And I was just like, what is this? Who is this guy? And I just thought, man, I want to play with him. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like, no, it's not that I'm like, oh, saxophone. It's like, no, that's a musician that I went, oh, that's inspiring. Mm-hmm. Same thing with somebody like Mike Seale. I saw him play with Jerry Douglas at Telluride, you know, Jerry Douglas Band, and was just like, man, this guy's really, he's unique and interesting in the way he plays. And so I think I'm just trying to, you know, as far as like the things that I'm doing, I don't know what my band will look like or sound will be like in the next 2 to 3 years. You know, it's hard to know, but I think that's part of what makes it exciting too, is just kind of going, what is inspiring in a moment?
Yeah.
Like, what's going to keep me inspired, and who are the musicians that inspire me? So it's more about, for me, not trying to choose a particular instrumentation right now, but rather go, who are the, like, you know, who are the musicians that inspire me, and the spirit in which they play, not the instruments they play.
And if you can
per se
surround yourself with that kind of energy, right,
good things
will
happen, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. And so doing a project like Weighted Mind, by stripping so many things away, I think helped me, at least has helped me be open to, as I've kind of started to come back into, you know, more of a full band. And there's like currently no saxophone on my new record. So that's interesting too, because I love playing with Eddie. It's just like, you know, kind of figuring out like what are the musicians in a live context, and, you know, like this album that I'm finishing right now isn't the only record I'm ever going to make. I want to make another bluegrass album at some point. I would love to make a really great bluegrass album.
Yeah.
I want to make a mandolin project soon. It's like there's a lot of things that I still want to do, and I think that's what, you know, hopefully fans, as they come to shows and they're watching you guys play or they're watching me play or whatever, like, just kind of understanding, like, you know, every album, every project, every live show is kind of its own thing. It's its own moment in time, you know? And when you hear people say, well, I wish they'd play more bluegrass. I wish they'd play more bluegrass. It's like, I love bluegrass. And if you were with me at every show, my husband Justin and I, we play as a duo some. It's something we're doing more and more of. And we're playing quite a bit of bluegrass,
yeah,
as a duo, going back to some stuff that we grew up loving and playing, covering some Larry Sparks songs and things like that. So, you know, I think by me kind of stepping away from it a little bit and kind of chasing after my own original thing, whatever that becomes or is, kind of almost strengthens my love for bluegrass even,
mm-hmm,
more, because when I do have a chance to go back and play it, there's this absolute childlike joy that I get from doing it that's just really rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I love that.
So,
well, I think I should say part of the reason that you find that people are digging your music and not necessarily judging it bluegrass or not is just because it's really good.
Well,
and
thank you.
You know, and I think I loved what you just said there, and, you know, lucky for us listeners, you're at the start of what appears to be an awesome and wide-ranging career. And if you guys have not checked Sierra out, make sure to give her music a listen. It's really incredible. And I just can't thank you enough for coming to hang with me today.
Man, thanks
to talk
for having
music.
Me.
And we're going to jam tonight. It's going to be awesome. So,
I'm excited,
Sierra,
and can't wait
so
to
much.
Hear, you know, future episodes of this. It's going to be a great podcast, I know. So congrats on
awesome.
Launching
thank,
this thing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a wrap on episode 3 of Inside the Musician's Brain. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 4, which features my interview with John Stickley, one of the most innovative bluegrass-based acoustic guitar players out there today. Thanks again for listening, and remember that you can check out Inside the Musician's Brain as a part of the Osiris Podcast Network.